Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to Science Faction, the only show where a scientist, a comedian, and a comedian scientist come together to discuss science comedically.
Hello, and welcome to Science Faction 578. Science Faction, cancer vaccines and inbreeding.
Again, all of our titles lately sound like Chuck Palahniuk books. Like, I mean, Bobby, have you been getting some outside help writing these episodes? Because I haven't heard a lot of Palahniuk lately.
I keep an old, wiry diesel mechanic slash writer in the basement of my house and just force him to churn out Science Faction episodes. You might have noticed that a lot of our recent Science Faction episodes have had a lot more sexual violence than they normally do.
Yeah, I didn't
normally
think that
do.
Scene where my anus got sucked out by a pool pump was necessary. But, I mean, hey,
Neither did the reading public, if you look at that.
Why did I have to do it in real fucking life? It's an audio medium, I kept saying to you. Nobody's going to see this. I could be pretty convincing. Can't you just shock my testicles and use that scream?
Oh, and speaking of the shocked scream of testicles, I, of course, am your host, comedian and archaeologist Robert Timothy. With me, as always, is my comedian, Mr. Damien Mercado. Damien, how are you doing this afternoon?
I am doing great, but I'd like to draw a distinction here. You said a shocked scream from testicles. Somebody screaming because their testicles were shocked is different than a shocked scream from testicles. Because I picture anthropomorphic...
It can be. It doesn't have to be. No, if you didn't know the electric shock was coming, you would be shocked by the shock.
Okay, but if I had your mouth, you were shocked, but for some reason, due to some protest, your mouth was duct taped, you're saying the scream would emanate from your testicles. Because that, to me, is comical. Anthropomorphized testicles...
Okay, I see what you're saying. No. Right. I think of the mouth as being the voice of the testicles because it is.
You know, back in like the 80s, I feel like in the 70s, there was a lot of comedies where like guys were trying to hide something, you know, either like a
separate head sewn onto their bodies.
Yeah, they have never done it with testicles. Like, what if a man's testicles could get like, hey, I got a testicle transplant. And turns out the guy's consciousness came with the balls.
Like, what if the balls were kind of like that TV trope of the good angel and the bad angel sitting on your shoulders? One good testicle and one bad testicle, and they're constantly giving you conflicting advice. And the only thing they agree on is that you should not be riding like a Huffy with a crossbar and hitting the brakes too quickly. Like, that's the only thing good and bad testicle are both on the board with.
Mr. Mercado, I know you've been waiting a long time for this testicle transplant. We were able to get two donors from two different sources, and we hope this is okay. Turns out one of your testicles was like a testicle of, I don't know, Bernie Sanders, and the other one was Alex Jones or something.
Yes. Yeah, that's what I'm thinking. It's basically like The Odd Couple, but with balls.
Listen, excuse me, you are on, please, Mr. Jones, get on your side of the scrotum. Do not make me draw a line down the perineum again.
I remember that episode.
Listen, Mr. Jones, you and I disagree a lot, but I think Mr. Timothy was right. I think we need to join together for a bipartisan meeting of the minds to ban bike handlebars.
And like, this guy's going crazy. Like, you know, there's like that Michigan J Frog thing. Like, doctor, I swear my balls are talking. And of course, they remain silent.
I'm guessing we got to go with Crazy as Balls as the title.
Rob Schneider is Crazy as Balls.
Rob Schneider plays both balls.
Nobody will work with the man. He's an anti-vaxxer.
Well, once you cast a ball perfectly, what are you going to do for the other one? You know.
I want you to know my dream casting was John Cena, but like for the dude with the scrotum.
You're going to do a twins version of balls?
Rob Schneider. You know, physically, Rob Schneider probably has, he doesn't have the body of an egg like Danny DeVito, but I'd rather have Danny DeVito 100 times.
I want to do a fun prank we do where we call up some Hollywood agents and we call up actors, like regular actors, like Tobey Maguire and stuff. And we go, hey, look, we got Chris Hemsworth involved. We would like to remake the movie Twins and we'd like it to star you. And he'd be like, oh, my God, wait, what? Wait, you think I'm fucking DeVito? No, I'm a fucking regular dude. I was like, I was part of the Rat Pack. What are you talking about? No, I can get girls. What? And then he just like runs to the gym.
Oh, my God, I'm being negged.
Finally, I can get Tobey Maguire back for what he's done. dear. All right, let's move right on to science articles.
From molecules to particles, this is Science Articles.
All right, article number one, what's good for the COVID is good for the cancer.
Is this what happens when, like, Ben Franklin's almanac starts making science books and, like, studies?
What's good for the COVID is good for the cancer.
This abstract doesn't say anything. It's just a fucking folksy saying.
That's why I treat cancer with reckless negligence.
And mercury.
And horse dewormers.
God damn it, we are living in the end times. And it's so much, like, I thought the end times would be so much cooler and like a fight for survival. Instead, it's just watching stupid people off themselves in like ways you did not think was going to happen 5 years ago.
Yeah, there's a lot more of like online voyeurism to the end of the world than I would have thought before.
Taking horse dewormer. By the way, Bobby, I've been reading this. How true is it? Ivermectin, does it sterilize you?
No.
Not you, because you're not taking it. But if you took it.
Over a population who is taking the, there will be a lowered fertility rate, but that is not a sterilization.
Okay, like for a temporary, like a temporary lowering of sperm or a permanent lowering?
We're not sure. We'll see.
I need a longitudinal semen sampling study done. Just start sending cups over to my house. I'll do the Pepsi challenge, and I'll let you know what the sperm count is.
Ironically, that would taste way better than Pepsi. All right, so let's go right on to this story.
Ouch.
Eat that, PepsiCo. You know what you've done. So Pfizer has developed an mRNA vaccine for cancer. This is really, really neat. The first mRNA vaccines ever created for humans were the COVID vaccines that we just debuted last year, at the end of last year, and already we're looking towards cancer. So how do cancer vaccines work? We've actually talked a lot about this on the show. If you go back to our very early episodes, one of our guest hosts, Jackie, would actually discuss this a lot. It coincided with some of the work that she was doing. And the idea of immunotreatments for cancer has always been a sought-after holy grail of cancer treatment. Because the idea is if you can get your own immune system to recognize and attack a tumor, well, then you won't need chemo. Then you don't need radiation. The whole point, the whole reason you need those things is because your body can't distinguish cancer, which is also your body, it's your own body cells, from other healthy cells. So your immune system can't really help out. The goal has always been if we can find a way to teach the immune system to target cancerous tumors and cancerous cells, well, then we don't need all these outside poisons dumping into your body. Your own immune system can take care of it. And oh yeah, by the way, the big problem we always know with cancer is even if somebody gets treated, oftentimes they'll go into remission, sometimes years, sometimes even decades later. Cancer pops back up. You don't have the chemo in your body anymore. You're not getting bombarded by radiation, so it just grows out of control. But if your immune system had already fought it off and killed it, then as soon as it starts springing back up, the immune system's going to do it again. And the idea of people dying because of cancer remission will likely, if they figure out immunotreatments, not really be a big deal anymore. Once you beat the cancer itself, your immune system will be able to keep it under control. So it's always been this kind of holy grail. We've talked about it for almost 10 years on this show. We've talked about this idea of using the immune system to take out cancer. However, there's a problem with it. What we want to happen is we want to stimulate cytokines. We talk about cytokine responses, it's part of the immune system. We want to stimulate cytokines to go after these tumors, these cancerous cells. But the problem is the cytokines we stimulate, especially if we add it someplace, they have a really short half-life. So if we, you know, kind of distill a bunch of cytokines out of somebody's blood and then inject them right near the thing, they'll die pretty quick. So getting your body to actually pump these out directly is a much better option, which is what we talked about before with mRNA vaccines. You're essentially introducing a little bit of code into your body, and your body knows how to process that type of code because it's the type of code it processes all the time to make proteins. So it processes that code and produces the proteins, and then therefore your body can have a chance to fight those things. In the case of COVID, it was the ACE2 spike protein that it would produce, and your body would learn to fight it. They are doing the same thing with cancer. And the effectiveness of this current Pfizer mRNA cancer vaccine for what they're using now is for melanomas and solid tumors, they did it on a mouse study. They looked at 20 mice with melanomas. 17 of these mice produced enough cytokines to effectively shrink the tumors to nothing within 40 days. Think of what that means. 17 out of 20 mice, and keep in mind, this is like the first phase of the vaccine. They might tweak this and get it much better. 17 out of 20 mice beat cancer. cancer. They're not getting extra drugs. They're not getting radiation. They're not getting chemo. Their bodies, their immune systems did this themselves. That is stunning. You can bet that with little tweaking, if we carried that ratio 17 out of 20 into human models, you could bet with a little bit of tweaking and with the addition of chemo and radiation and drugs and everything else, we could get that near 100%. That's fucking stunning. And it, their bodies did it by themselves in just over a month.
So I know that cancer, there's a lot of variation in cancer, but this is like a one-size-fits-all solution you could do, or is there like one for...
Yeah, like I said, now it would be for melanomas and solid tumor-type cancers. So this would not be necessarily be good for like blood cancers, leukemias, probably not for the bone marrow cancers, that kind of stuff yet, but hopefully soon. Yeah, hopefully soon they'd be able to do that as well. It's just, it would be a different vaccine, but the thing is the same. The idea is the same. You're essentially just training your immune system to output a bunch of stuff or to recognize a certain thing by training your body to output a bunch of stuff. So there's no reason it wouldn't work for things like leukemia as well.
So like basically this cytokine, I believe you said, cytokine, it is just it is a chemical your body makes that allows your body to identify the cancer. It can no longer hide as three cancer cells in a trench coat.
No, it's part of your immune system that actually attacks things. So we talked before about like cytokine storms where you actually have an overactive immune system and that could be dangerous. That's where your immune system goes crazy out of hand and is totally like attacking it. It's one of, similar to T cells being one part of your immune system, it's another part of your immune system.
I think this might be the first time we've talked about T cells and you did not make a Mr. T joke. You're growing, Bobby.
Well, I do pity that fool
God
that couldn't
fucking
go through without
you.
Making a single Mr. T joke.
I thought there was some sort of growth. I was about to present you with a certificate. Mr. T was actually going to present it to you, but now he's gone. He's getting back on a plane to wherever he lives. He wouldn't tell me, and I was afraid to ask.
T-Town?
Because I always thought the problem with cancer was that it was able to disguise itself from your immune system so well.
Yeah, well, it does. It's not even have to disguise itself. It's just your own body's cells. And so your own body hasn't learned to fight it. Cytokines are a little bit more specialized. They're usually kind of like the first responders as things come in. And they are able to distinguish cancer cells if we essentially train them the right way. So what we're doing is getting the body to produce proteins that look a lot like these cancer cells so that the cytokines can recognize them and then attack those cancer cells. And if you think about it, mRNA is like a uniquely good tool to fight cancer. We talked before about how it's cheap to utilize because you're able to essentially just use your body's own production strain to produce the proteins you're looking for. It's easy to produce, incredibly fast to produce. We talked about how the COVID vaccines were both produced within like 2 days. It took them 2 days to basically write out the code and get everything. Everything else was testing. And if you think of like cancer, which can kind of throw some curveballs your way, it could need there could be certain modifications based on the individual person's body type and cells and everything, all this stuff. The ability to kind of change things very quickly is really useful. And with mRNA vaccines, you can literally change it in a day or two. You could make up a completely different vaccine and put it out. And, you know, based on the COVID things, at least have a pretty decent chance of it working. And so the kind of flexibility that we see with mRNA vaccines are going to lead them to be a uniquely good tool in the fight for a cancer vaccine, so to speak. And the fact that your body produces these machineries and these cells are probably also why it's so effective. Because again, your immune system is also going to be looking for something your body produces. So if it gets trained on something your body has produced, it is probably more likely to be successful. These numbers that are coming out on these mouse models are crazy. Like it is very rare to see a cancer study that shows...
We had to 5150 them. They're crazy. It's
they're nutty ass mice.
They're seeing a doctor right now. They're getting the help that they deserve.
But to see these type of numbers, 17 essentially completely went into remission on their own with no exterior treatment in 40 days. Like these numbers are crazy. They've already enrolled people in the first human study, and this might really like throw things for a loop. It led me to thinking, like when I start looking back, the survivability of cancer over our lifetimes, Damien. Damien, you were born in 1983. I was born just after 1984.
Youngin.
During the time that we have been alive, cancer survival has like quintupled. depending on what cancer you have and stuff. But, like, it used to be that if you had, you know, stage 4 lung cancer, you were dead. That was dead. You were long dead. Why are we even talking to you anymore? You should just bury yourself at this point. Now we can treat people. Like, it's amazing. Pancreatic cancer used to be 100% death sentence within, like, 12 months. And now there are people who survive and they get beyond it. Certain glioblastomas and stuff like that, they've gone from essentially completely a fatality for getting it to, actually, you might survive. And so has things like breast cancer and colon cancer and prostate cancer. Like, over our lifetimes, Damien, we have seen the cancer treatment equivalent of, like, the introduction of antibiotics in terms of, like, lifespan differences and stuff.
There is a funny, because my wife works at a hospital and she brings home, like, statistics, you know, for the county and, you know, the country. Sure. And everything. And we also just read through patients' files just for a laugh.
Look at this guy's weird dick.
God, the doctor was allowed to take a picture? Take it in portrait mode, you dick. God, why? This is a terrible picture. Yes, we talked about all these cancers that are getting better, but one that doesn't seem to be getting better. Yes, the methods to treat it are getting much better.
Sure.
But one we expect to see going down, but it's not. It's colon cancer. And it's basically just...
That's just because of bad eating, right?
Well, I mean, yeah. I mean, I assume so. I would assume it would come from just a good old American barbecue diet.
Yeah.
But no, it's actually gone up because in order to get it, you have to get checked. And so many men are so homophobic, especially the boomers who are aging into this right now, is that, like, the thought of, like, I had my butt fingered 5 years ago. Do I have to go in and do it again? Oh, the doctor's going to think I'm gay because I got hard again.
And then asked him out.
So I think that's kind of funny that, like guys are like, listen, I'd rather be dead of cancer than have somebody think I was gay because I had a routine medical procedure. And by the, oh, that person, I mean me. I think I'm gay because I had the procedure.
Well, I'm amazed. I think it's going to be one of those things where, like, our grandkids will look at us and be like, dude, cancer fucked your generation up? What the hell? They're going to say that the same way we look at people and be like, wait, what do you mean typhoid killed half your friends when you were a kid? What the fuck is that? Like, we don't have that anymore. I don't know what that is. You're dumb for having died from it. Like, I'll just put it that way.
My grandfather, who I never met, my biological grandfather on my dad's side, I never met the guy. But because he died of cancer before I was too young, and I heard that like the chemo that the treatments they give him, you know, this is like when my dad was like 14. This is quite a bit ago.
Sure,
quite a bit ago as far as cancer research and treatment has come.
I think back then they just punched the cancer. Like, they were just like, oh, you got some cancer first. And by the way, that was an evolution, because before they'd be like, you got cancer, let's just punch you. So, like, for a while, they'd be like, well, you got cancer because the devil hates gays or something like that. And so then they would just, like, they'd be like, okay, you caught it. That must mean the devil hates you. We'll punch you in the face. But the problem was people would die too quickly, you know, because they were cancer patients.
Where we've tried the letting him drink whiskey for six months treatment, and that didn't work. Turns out he looks less healthy.
Yeah, then the kind of like snowflake young doctors came up with like a new procedure where they would cut the patient open and just punch the cancer itself. Just repeatedly punch the cancer.
The young hotshot progressive doctor.
Yeah. Meanwhile, they have like a Marlboro hanging out of their mouth as they're doing it. They probably ash it in your open abdominal cavity.
All the old timey doctors look like Polly from Rocky. And it's like, oh, look at this. From liberal John Hopkins Medical Institute. Gonna teach me how to punch cancer out of a patient? Yeah, right.
It was like back in the day where you would call a nurse into the operating room just so you came in and you could squeeze her ass. Then you'd tell her to go leave and get you a daiquiri.
Well, I don't know how true this is, but I've been told that, like, back when he got cancer, like, they just were like, well, just drink this 5-gallon jug of chemo. I know they don't drink it, but, like, take way too much chemo. Apparently he broke his arm, because he was so weak from just hitting a stapler, trying to staple a piece of paper.
Wow.
So his last couple months were pretty terrible.
His stapler waited a long time to get that vengeance. 30 years you've been punching me!
To be fair, there was an old-timey stapler. As a matter of fact, like, as a kid, I was walking in the room, the stapler punched me. Like, get the hell out of here, kid!
Get out of here!
Kids are meant to be seen, not heard. I killed your grandfather! I broke his arm! Don't make me break your arm, too!
Send one of those sweet tit nurses in here!
And then it slapped my grandmother's ass. All right, well, this is pretty cool. I mean, this is awesome. This is, I mean, we've talked before about how mRNA treatments are going to be the future of medicine or part of the future of medicine. And so, Bobby, so we all know, like, you know, there are big diseases you could probably treat or have some, you know, like Alzheimer's, having a scrotum filled with the soles of two very different...
balls.
Having balls with the soles of two very different political ideologies inside you. Soon our mRNA will be able to fix that. But, Bobby, you... Captain Science, which is what we're going to call you once you get bitten by a radioactive atom.
Uh-huh. Which happens.
Because there are many radioactive atoms. What do you think is going to be the next disease that, like, if Bobby, you're in charge of the John Hopkins Medical Research Center.
Honestly, I think the big one that's going to come out, we talked about this a few months ago, is probably a universal flu vaccine, because that is going to save a ton of lives. It's needed around the world, and mRNA vaccines are doing, at least in trial research, such better jobs than our current vaccine types that it would almost be kind of be medical malpractice for Pfizer and other companies to not explore that option, because with how many flu deaths we have every year and the ineffectiveness of the flu vaccine every year, it would be crazy for us to not tackle it. So I would say probably influenza, but frankly, almost everything. I think all the vaccines that we currently have will be replaced by mRNA vaccines in short order, because they are just so much better in every way except storage, like cold chain storage. So you might still need to use traditional vaccines in places that are hard to get to and don't have cold storage infrastructure and stuff. But for pretty much everybody, if you live in a city, if you got paved roads and you're shitting inside, I think you're going to get mRNA vaccine soon.
Well, I don't live in a city, and I shit my pants because I'm all hopped up on ivermectin. Also, I seem to have lost my sight. Could somebody take me to a doctor if the ERs aren't full?
And then the evil ball is going like, nah, you don't need no doctor. I'll tell you what you do. You take more of that ivermectin, and then let's go take out that sweet nurse and her ass in the OR. Let's go see over there. And then the good ball is like, no, we really should go to the hospital. That's the responsible thing to do. Don't forget your insurance card, by the way. That might be hard on the intake nurse if you don't have it. And then there's just a ball scrum.
Do you think that the good ball, whenever you are passed out, like, let's just say the good ball waits for the evil testicle and you to go to sleep, and then it takes control of the body, and you wake up and you find yourself about to get a vaccine?
Anybody, by the way, anybody who thinks this is, like, not a clever show idea or would never make air has never seen what happened in the 90s, because there was a worse version of this called Herman's Head that was absolutely on TV.
Yes, that was the thing. Like, I'm trying to explain how shitty and bad 80s and 70s writing was to somebody born since the 90s is, you can't do it. Like, people just didn't give a fuck about writing at some point.
Herman's Balls is a show I would have watched, actually.
By the way, you know how ivermectin, you know, going back to ivermectin, it's like a, you know, they make it in like apple flavor for horses and everything.
Yeah.
How long till they come out with a Mountain Dew flavor? Like, listen, people are eating this and we know the people eating this. Why not do a Mountain Dew flavor?
Article number two, first ever big Turkish genetic study reveals lots of taboo.
Like step taboo?
No. Legit taboo.
Like, oh, listen, my stepmother got stuck in sarcophagus. What was I supposed to do? Old half.
Sarcophagus?
I assume they had them at some point in Turkey.
Broad areas of the world?
Are you telling me that there was a single sarcophagus in all of Turkey?
I mean, I'm not saying that, but...
Sounds like, all right, well then, just give me my win and I call BS and I'll be on my way.
So this starts out with just a regular story, but it's actually a really interesting journey, because I got to a point in a regular news story that came out where I was like, wait, hold on, what the fuck? And then I went down a science research rabbit hole that lasted many, many, many hours. And as I like
well,
to
if
do...
if you stop masturbating every 10 seconds to the stuck porn, it would have been much shorter.
What do you think is in the hole?
Knowledge, Bobby. Knowledge.
And as I like to do, I bring that back to you guys and be like, look at this weird science thing I found. So anyway, let's start with the actual story. So this is in, of course, Damien's favorite publication, PNAS. And the story starts with the first ever large genetic study of modern Turkish people, more than 3,300 of them. First of all, first question, why is this the first ever broad scale genetic study of Turkish people? Shouldn't we have had this? We've done a bunch of other people. We did everything. Europeans, Africans, Asians, Native Americans, Australians. They just kind of slipped through. I don't know what to tell you other than the fact that they have slipped through. There just hasn't been a lot of genetic stuff done there. That has a little bit to do maybe with some religious undertones of the communities in which research is done. But for whatever reason, there just has not been a lot of Turkish genetic studies, especially compared comparative genetic studies that looked at big sample sizes of unrelated people.
See, I thought it was you were going to say because we've talked on the show before about how much science is catered to white men, usually in their 20s, basically grad student age. And so I thought you was going to fall into, the same reason we don't have a lot of information about Native Americans, about African Americans, et cetera, et cetera. But you're saying...
But we do have it on African Americans. We do have it on Native Americans. We do have it on Asian people and everybody. We just didn't have it on Turkey.
Specifically Turkey, not the people of the Middle East.
There's much more done on Middle Eastern people, yes, in general.
Okay.
So anyway, very interesting. And like the genetics of people from Turkey is pretty important to understanding world genetics. It's the crossroads of Europe and Asia. And as we've talked about on this show before, if you are a European, you're actually Turkish. Because what happened is, 40 some odd thousand years ago, when Homo sapiens first occupied Europe, they occupied that area, they lived there for tens of thousands of years. And then starting about 10,000 years ago, agriculture was developed in Turkey. And the people who developed it came storming through Europe and basically completely took over, almost completely displacing the original native population. And then a couple thousand years later, when they got really good at pastoralism, herding animals, those people, also from Turkey, swept in again and took over again and completely displaced what was left of the original inhabitants, as well as along a lot of their earlier Turkish brethren that had come through. So basically, if you are talking about Europe, you're talking about Turkish people.
They have the oil wrestling. We're not talking like foxy boxing wrestling, but like where dudes get greased up and they wrestle like they're trying to catch a pig in America.
Okay. It's interesting what you do and don't know about cultures. Like sarcophagus, you just fit into Turkish culture, but you have a lot of knowledge about their oil wrestling.
Well, I masturbate to one and not the sarcophagus. All right, I was just saying...
Not since the incident.
I was saying watching muscly, hairy, sweaty guys roll around in oil is a pastime we all share, and probably for this reason.
So they found a lot of interesting genetic diversity there. They found lineages that are completely contained within Turkey, as far as we can tell. We found some interesting haplotypes and different genetic groupings and all the stuff we would expect, because, like, again, Turkey, crossroads of Europe and Asia. You know, Mongols came through there, Huns came through there, everybody came through there, going back and forth. Genetically, they're a very important group of people, so found some very interesting stuff there. However, they also found that about 50% of individuals showed high levels of inbreeding, which led me down a science research rabbit hole of interesting family-banging research. So really quickly, I want to just distinguish between incest and inbreeding. So incest is a particular event that happens between two relatives.
And it's filmed.
Not always, but inbreeding is basically a continual mating of familial members within any given group. So it's more than just one instance of it. So I'm going to ask this question, Damien, something that I did a lot of research to find out. And I want you to give me your best answer, and I want you to tell me why. What country do you think has the most inbreeding?
Now, it's easy to take a cheap shot at Appalachia. But I know
we
are...
I'll give you a group of people, too. So if you want to say Appalachian, I'll give that to you.
No. I think we're new to the game. I think, just as like a lot of Americans think, we're the greatest country in the world. But in actuality, mm-hmm. China, there have been a lot of civilizations that have accomplished great things,
Sure.
I feel like American exceptionalism, I feel like we think we're the best at inbreeding, but we're not. We haven't had enough time to really set in. I think I'm going to go with the big name, the Habsburgs, Ottoman Empire, which Turkey, is there.
Well, I mean, the Habsburgs were all of Europe.
Yes, they did very well. Not all the royal family. Yes, all the royal families had inbreeding in all the world, but the Habsburgs had the Habsburg chin. Like they were.
But what I'm saying is the Habsburgs weren't Turkey. The Habsburgs were the king of Spain, the king of Germany, the king of France, the second cousin, queen of England, king of Russia.
I just thought the Ottoman Empire, which encompassed Turkey, and the Byzantine. I didn't think it went on to France and everything, but
it didn't. No, these are. They're their own nations. The Habsburgs became kings of basically every nation in England, or every nation in Europe, by marriage going into it. It wasn't like they were kings of one solid empire, and then that empire broke up. They were like one family that slowly spread out and occupied the different niches around them.
Oh, well then, yeah, I'd have to go to the Habsburgs. I'm sticking with my answer, then the Habsburgs. Yeah, if you have like a sexy Spanish cousin, a sexy French cousin, so on and so forth, you might convince yourself that you're spreading it all over, but you're still shitting in the same pool.
you're definitely right. The Habsburgs had a lot of inbreeding problems. It led to a big deal. I mean, because what they realized is, you know, if you breed in, okay, so now we're married our son to this person's daughter, so now our son is going to be king of Spain, or our grandson or something. Well, what they realized is somebody else could just come do the same thing. Like, the Fletchers could come in, and then they could marry in and screw us over. So they just kept marrying a cousin into there so that nobody else could get a stronghold. And they did this with, like, every country. They, like, became the rulers, and then they had this special, like, style of marrying their kids off that basically made that happen. And that's the reason, like, everybody was first cousin. You know, like, when World War I breaks out, the Tsar of Russia is first cousins with the King of England and blah, 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 blah.
I never understood why you not just go out in the town, find an attractive peasant girl, raise her standard of living. She'll be super grateful. Her family isn't going to look to overthrow the throne. In fact, you could probably have her whole family killed. There's nothing she could do about it.
I'm kind of glad you're not a king, actually.
Listen, I am not a psychopath or a sociopath, but I know I've seen Game of Thrones, and I know the way the game is played. So I'm just saying, those are the options on the table when you're a ruler.
And the Habsburgs ended up inbreeding so much that not only did they have, you know, the Habsburg chin, and so, you know, sometimes they had like mental problems.
Lumpy
their
scrotum.
Tongues were so big they could, yeah, the tugs were so big they couldn't talk, and a lot of them were sterile, which ended up being the end of that dynasty. So anyway, Habsburgs were a great example of inbreeding. That's just one family, though. I don't have to give that a group, but if you look around at countries, can you guess what country you would think would have the biggest inbreeding problem?
You know, on this show, we shit on the Irish a lot, so let's go them.
Okay, fair enough. You know, a lot of drinking, there's a lot of kids around. You never know when you accidentally bang one of them. Who knows what's going on?
A lot of your cousins look the same when you're three sheets to the wind.
Well, a paper in the early 2000s came out and noted high levels of inbreeding in Brazil, Japan, India, and Israel.
Modern day Brazil, Japan,
yes.
And India?
Yes.
That is shocking.
That is not necessarily shocking because
Japan
they're not talking
India.
About the country as a whole. So India is 1. Some odd billion people. What they were seeing is small groups in remote areas that basically didn't have access to the outside world, and they would constantly inbreed among themselves. Japan also had some issues. Now, keep in mind, this doesn't necessarily mean like a father is banging his daughter. A lot of these, in fact, the vast majority of these are first or second cousin marriages, and those tend to go along cultural lines. There was also things with certain Hasidic Jews, blah, 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 blah. So there was a bunch of stuff going on with those countries.
Good enough for Einstein, good enough for old Damien. It's not good enough for my cousin, though, apparently.
But the one that takes the cake by far is Pakistan. In Pakistan, more than 50% of all marriages are to a first or second cousin. Let that sink in. More than 50%. That means if you are hanging out in Pakistan and you're with one of your buddies, chances are either you or your buddy are married to your cousin.
Whereas, like, in Western nations, we reserve that for royalty or celebrities.
Yeah.
You're saying,
yeah,
like, they're much more an egalitarian culture where the common man can marry a cousin.
They love Jerry Lee Lewis, and they really support everything.
Great balls of fire. I got two souls in my scrotum. Great balls of fire.
That's what that song was about. It's about the differing advice you get from a good versus a bad ball.
All right, scrotum, what do you think? Sleep with my cousin or not? Well, obviously, you guys are split on the issue, so I'll just decide. Oh, both of you are actually agreeing on this. It's all a go. All right.
That type of cousin marriage is actually fairly common through certain parts of the world. It's incredibly common in most of the Islamic world.
Is there a cultural thing? Is a clan system that makes that?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, you are, and it's considered very, very common to marry your father's brother's daughter. That is the most common marriage relationship in Pakistan. And it goes out through a lot of the Middle East as well. And there are other parts that have similar inclinations to marry. Usually it's further out, second or third cousin or something along those lines. I mean, keep in mind, if you live in a Bedouin culture, the groups around you might not be like you. You're nomadic. You're very different. You have very different cultural norms and things like that. It would be pretty hard to kind of marry around into the surrounding settled cultures around you. Whereas, you know, your other Bedouin buddies that are down the road, oh, they marry them. That daughter knows how to cook the right Bedouin food and treat her Bedouin man. And so in a way, it kind of makes sense, especially if you don't have knowledge of how genetics work. And it can lead to big problems. So there are big issues right now in Pakistan with significant amounts of birth defects attributed to inbreeding. In fact, about 50% of birth defects in not only Pakistan, but in Pakistani immigrant groups. For instance, there was a big study done on Pakistani immigrants in London. About 50% of birth defects are due to inbreeding. It's incredibly common and super sad. And the really sad part is, let's say a random person listening to this now comes from Western culture. Let's say they decide to marry their cousin one day. Technically, the chances of you having a kid with birth defects because you married your cousin is actually not that high. It's like God gives you a one fuck your cousin and get away with it chance. Like, he's like, all right, but just you two. You two can do it, but no one else. The problem becomes when you come from a culture where that is in your lineage on both sides. Because what ends up happening is the deleterious genes you have then don't have a good copy of the gene to kind of make up for it. And any bad copy you have anywhere down the line essentially gets passed down as an inherited trait. And it can cause a lot of problems. You'll see, like, apologists trying to explain this away and be like, well, it's only like a 3% increase. And it's like, yeah, it's a 3% increase of birth defects from 3%. So, like, saying I just doubled how many kids will have tragic birth defects is not an okay way to explain away this inbreeding thing. Like, it is a real problem. It is a serious issue. And in other communities throughout the Middle East, it's an issue as well. There are other places where people get trapped on islands, let's say, and this will become a problem. You know, Pitcairn Island, where people famously got marooned and shipwrecked, and the marooned shipwrecked people basically made a whole new population. You know, you can only have so many people when you have a founding population that's so small. So very, very, very interesting. I got really interested in looking up, like, levels of inbreeding, where it's happened the most. Like, it used to be much more common that people would marry their cousins. That was common throughout the world. And it wasn't until, like, the Catholic Church came around and said, you're not allowed to do that it started becoming taboo and spreading around. And there's actually a lot of thought that that prohibition against cousin marriage is one of the things that delineated the Western world from almost everybody else at the time.
You know, fucking religion took another great thing of humanity away from us. No, that's actually probably the only good thing the Catholic Church has done. So, way to go.
You must have some uggo cousins.
No, I don't. I just have discipline. And because, yeah, you know what? If I was the first guy to shit in the genetic pool, our family's genetic pool, I could probably do it and get away with it. But I'm not. All right? A bunch of people have come in this inbred lake. I can't come in it anymore.
Hopefully what happens is those groups end up getting some much needed genetic diversity inserted in there. You know, you get a couple of generations of people marrying outside the family and you can almost reset that. And so hopefully we get to the point where that becomes a thing that the culture allows to happen. Because it's got to be super sad if you're a doctor who, like, let's say you're a doctor in London, so you're just used to a normal rate of birth defects. And then you go and you work in a Pakistani neighborhood and you're like, holy fuck, there's twice as many birth. You guys, you realize this is a serious problem. Like, what's going on? Oh, why do you guys look the same and have the same last name before marriage? Oh, okay, here's what's wrong.
I think it's saddest for the kid. You know, they didn't. Yeah. They didn't ask this.
Of course not.
I've actually, you know, I've seen Bedouins. You know, I know mm-hmm. I know the sure. vast desert sea that they have to cross just to, you know, go see the next family over, the next clan yeah. over. It's not that lightweight in Pakistan though, is it? Like, it's much more urban, right?
No, it's no. You're talking about the Pakistan-Afghanistan border. It's mountainous and, like,
okay.
It's basically autonomous from the rest of Pakistan because you know Islamabad can't even rule over it because it's just wild.
Oh, so this isn't even like if I went to Islamabad and chose
the,
like,
you know, you would still have it in Islamabad. Here's the thing: in Islamabad, if about 52% of all marriages you will find in that area are first or second cousins. If you go up into the rural mountains, it's close to 80%.
I guess, like, in the city, they're like, well, why stop a good thing?
I'm no